I didn't have a cold open topic today. Normally I do.
Okay.
So I don't know how we want to test the audio. Do you want to do some vocal warm-ups or something? We could sing Shoop. Here I go, here I go, here I go. Okay, girls, what's my weakness?
What is that?
You don't know Shoop?
No.
It's a Salt and Pepper song from the 90s.
Who or what is Salt and Pepper?
They're a girl rap group.
Did they do that one about Scruds or Scruffs or something?
Scrubs? No, that's TLC.
Right. Half marks.
Don't be too hard on yourself. Rap is hard. Not one of us gives Chet Hanks enough credit. Welcome to Save Me From My Shelf, a literature podcast where we take classic tomes off their pedestal to make you less anxious about reading them. Our jokes come from a place of love and for a specific teaching purpose. However, if you think that making fun of great literature, and maybe some mild swearing, is offensive, this might not be the podcast for you. Hello, you are listening to Save Me From My Shelf. Doctor Who over here is Daniel.
Dr. Quinn, medicine woman, is Abby.
So this is a reminder that here at Aston University, Daniel and I teach on the English Lit program, and we also have an MA in English. And if you're feeling generous, you like the show, want to help keep it afloat, we also have a Patreon. And we just had a delightful time with our last Patreon book group, where we talked about the book and the film, Poor Things. I was thinking that we should do more for the Patreon, and we could, like, really sell out. What do you think about doing Save Me From My Shelf on ice?
I can't even ice skate.
That's what I was going to ask you. Have you ever been ice skating?
I have been ice skating. I mean, I was all right, but I wouldn't call myself confident enough to perform at any event known as something on ice.
Are you like one of those kids that needs the milk crates that are stacked up?
That's what I'm thinking. I was wondering if I could have that for the show.
This will surprise you not at all, but I had 6 to 8 years of figure skating.
Yeah, that's not at all surprising. Anyway, thank you all the patrons. I don't know what are they called? Patrons.
Patrons.
Thank you, the patrons.
So, Daniel, what is our text today?
Hello, I'm Daniel, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Daniel.
I'm addicted to the 1890s. It started, innocently enough, with an interest in threshing machines and industrialized palm oil production. But I kept wanting more. I kept seeking out bigger and bigger thrills. At night, you know, I felt I could hear it at the window, tapping, visiting me, draining me of my strength. I have no idea when the craving's gonna hit. It's like I become another person, a depraved little man with an insatiable interest in bicycles and cycling magazines. You wouldn't know it to look at me. If anything, I'm fresher faced than ever before. But somewhere my soul is being corroded by this need for typewriters, early cinema, and liberated women. Today, though, I've made a big decision. I'm going to visit the 1890s one last time to rid myself of this compulsion once and for all. I'm going to go back and murder the man whose ideas have enabled me to travel back to this wanton decade. The bell has tolled for thee, Mr. H.G. Wells, author of The Time Machine, 1895.
I like that. You're getting a little creative with that one.
I was alluding to other texts that we did from the 1890s.
Yes, we got it. Yeah. We got the joke.
Okay.
So it should go without saying, we are about to spoil this text for you. In terms of the content, there are fires, bludgeoning, drowning. Don't laugh at that. Predatory animals, darkness, if anyone out there is scared of the dark, and sort of existential evolutionary dread. Do you reckon I should do some background today?
Yes, please.
Because this is my area of expertise. I just wrote a book, and there is a chapter that has quite a bit of focus on H.G. Wells and this text in particular.
Is this all a big plug?
It is, actually. The whole podcast was just a ploy to sell another 3 copies of my book.
When are we going to do more administrative?
No, no, no. You got to start up your own podcast. This was for me.
Oh.
So, H.G. Wells was a British author born to a lower middle class family in 1866, and both of his parents had previously worked as servants, so he was very concerned with issues of class and had sort of internalized a lot of his lower middle class status. So, class is going to be very important to this book, as will be made painfully obvious. So, the author Jules Verne, who you guys would know from Around the World in 80 Days, or Journey to the Center of the Earth, or 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, he was really annoyed that H.G. Wells just kind of made up the science in his books. But actually, Wells's work was deeply rooted in scientific thought and philosophy, even if they do kind of play fast and loose with it. They take a bit of a fantastical turn. So Wells is most famous for including ideas around the evolutionary theories of Charles Darwin in his works, and he is known today as the father of science fiction. So it's important to note that science fiction was not the term they used at the time. A lot of his books are known as scientific romances, and romance, I think we've said this on the show, but romance as a literary term doesn't mean, you know, oh, it's a story about love and relationships, but rather, it's a story that's outside of day-to-day reality. So anything that we would now classify as sci-fi, fantasy, horror, historical fiction, anything supernatural, or even anything like adventure fiction, like some adventure fiction, would likely be deemed a romance.
I was just going to say that science fiction owes a lot to satire. When I was reading this, I really felt like I was reading a kind of continuation of Gulliver's Travels, but one where you're trying to, maybe Wells is trying to sort of situate it within scientific discourse. So Wells coined the term time machine. It wasn't the first book about time machines. So Wells himself wrote one called The Chronic Argonauts in 1888. That is cool, isn't it? Yeah, Chronic Argonauts.
So yeah, people were clearly starting to come up with this idea, getting interested in the idea of time travel. Wells is the first person to really kind of make it happen in fiction. Yeah. So we see a lot of scientific thought in Wells's other books. He was really interested in space travel, vivisection, which is what they called animal experimentation in the 1890s, and like particularly grisly animal experimentation. The science of language and consciousness, etc. So he had a lot of things that he was really fixated on that he worked into his books. He was a really prolific writer, but his big claim to fame were the big four scientific romances that he wrote as a young man. And these are The Time Machine, The Island of Dr. Moreau, The Invisible Man, which is not to be confused with Invisible Man, the Ellison book.
Oh, yeah.
And The War of the Worlds. So he wrote four groundbreaking novellas in 4 years, and that solidified his early reputation as a genius. Unfortunately, this sort of early critical reputation suffered almost immediately after. He was a very political writer, and his works got increasingly preachy and propagandistic. He wrote a lot of utopias, which were, of course, like really easy to parody.
He was like a sort of socialist in that sort of classic 1890s kind of, we can perfect this way. But also, he was a big eugenicist as well, which I suppose back then people didn't see those two as maybe mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
And he met Stalin as well, I think, didn't he?
Yeah, he interviewed Stalin.
Yeah, wow, there you go.
So here's something that I wanted to talk about specifically, which is Wells' popularity. So his work was very commercially successful. This meant he got a lot of pushback from the great literary writers of the day, like Henry James and other burgeoning modernists, and they thought his work was trash. This is a big tension between genre fiction and, quote, literary fiction even today, and it still operates on class, gender, and racial lines, so you guys need to pay attention to this. Like, if you are picking on a book for being kind of trashy and, it's just popular, everyone likes it, and it's not worthy of our esteem, what are you really criticizing about it? Because a lot of this is internalized class stuff or gender stuff. The idea of who makes taste, who decides what's literary.
Yeah. I was also thinking, though, that it's funny because modernism is often about like playing with time and stuff and playing with interiority. And I suppose, isn't science fiction kind of doing stuff like that too, but from a more literal vantage? So they're all really singing from the same hymn sheet. Come on, guys.
So we open on an unnamed narrator who's talking about an unnamed protagonist, so two different unnamed people, and our protagonist only goes by the Time Traveler. The Time Traveler, the unnamed narrator tells us, has invited a bunch of his upper-middle-class buddies to this big Victorian shindig. And just about everyone there, all men, of course, is referred to by their sort of bougie job title rather than by name. Almost nobody in this book has a name. So we have the psychologist, the mayor, the physician, the newspaper editor, etc., etc. The time traveler appears to be some sort of, like, gentleman scientist or inventor or something. It's unclear exactly what he does with himself all day, but suffice to say, my dude is probably not putting in regular shifts down at the mill. You know who I couldn't stop picturing as the time traveler? Who's that useless rich guy? The one that everyone says looks like a haunted pencil?
Baudelaire.
No, the Waitrose finest Himmler. Jason Moggsy.
Oh, Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Jason Moggsy would be his common alter ego. All right, Moggsy. All right. Very lucky.
Well, now I have to call him that.
The time traveler and his guests, they're all having a chat. And the time traveler's like, I say, chaps, I've got a new theory about time and space. Long story short, I've invented a time machine.
So, time machine? What's a time machine?
Yeah, it is like that. He brings out this, like, invention. It's a little, quote, glittering metallic framework. And our narrator is fascinated by it and calls it, quote, an absolutely unaccountable thing. I thought it was funny that it's all got, like, ivory bits and stuff. It's very sort of steampunk. It's very Victorian, isn't
yes.
it? Yeah. Why would you have to have all the... Oh, the ivory's necessary for time purposes. You know, you don't need that.
I assume that was a slightly colonialist reading, because there's lots of stuff in this about empire. And
that's definitely true.
He doesn't describe it very well.
No.
He's ambiguous about it, much like in Frankenstein, she doesn't really describe how the monster comes to life, what the process is.
You want that, though, don't you? I think that's a good move.
Yes.
Unlike with Jules Verne. So, anyway... The time traveller is like, well, I've almost done working on this new invention, so you guys, you lads, me old muckers, come back to dinner in a few days. And I think there's a bit in this section where they talk about how the time traveller does all these, like, little shows and pranks, and they talk about how he'd shown them, like, a ghost last Christmas, but it was, like, a sort of prank thing.
Is that like a
stage?
Pepper's ghost?
Yes, like that sort of thing. So, I don't know what, like you say, what it is he does for a living that he would, or just, like... Who is this guy that half the time comes up with, like, magic tricks, and then also just, yeah, I met a time machine. It's no biggie.
Maybe I shouldn't be stamping on the creative types, and one is loath to sound like a Victorian capitalist oneself, but I do want to scream, get a job!
What's the opposite of diversify? Pick a lane.
So all these men do as he asks, and they return a few days later. And they're all sitting around in his house, shooting the breeze, but where's our host? Where's the time traveler? Geez, our hungry man dinners are gonna go cold? Like, should we start eating without him? After a while, the time traveler bursts into the room like Aragorn at Helm's Deep, and he's looking like he's crawled there from the ass end of hell, and there's a big studio audience gasp from the men. Quote, he was in an amazing plight. His coat was dusty and dirty, and smeared with green down the sleeves. His hair disordered. And as it seemed to me, grayer. His face was ghastly pale, his chin had a brown cut on it, half healed, and his expression was haggard and drawn, as by intense suffering.
Half healed. That is already real. We know it's real now.
I know, that's a nice detail. Yeah. So the time traveler immediately chugs some dude's glass of champagne, and then he falls on a plate of mutton like an animal. And so once he's eaten and cleaned up a little bit and becomes a bit more civilized, you know, quote unquote, all the men retire to the drawing room for brandy and cigars like those rich assholes on the Titanic. And it's here that the time traveler agrees to tell his associates about the last 8 days of his life. But no interruptions now. I'm going to tell you this whole story. And so what follows for us is word for word what our unnamed narrator hears directly from the time traveler.
It's a bit like Turn of the Screw.
Yes, they love this sort of relay narration. It's also the exact structure we would see in Heart of Darkness a few years later.
I really thought it was a lot like, well, we can talk about that later.
Yeah, but it's experimental in that way.
Yeah, that's also bollocks though. I was thinking, like, why would you come late to dinner? No matter how flustered you may be, you could just be like, well, I might as well come half an hour earlier.
That's a very good point, unless my dude likes a dramatic entrance.
Okay, so Again, he's half genius, half showman.
Some might say the greatest showman. So now, someone talking without pause for 100 pages straight might stretch our credulity, but I would like to point out that this is the late Victorian era, so cocaine could easily be in play here.
Okay, so the time traveler begins his narration. 8 days ago, he finished his machine and decided to test it out himself, even though he knew that this could very well spell his death.
You're really leaning on that acting button today,
yeah,
Daniel.
I'm a showman, half genius. So, he doesn't do a whistle-stop tour of history, does he, like Bill and Ted? Which you seem to think is safer.
Well, you'd know roughly what to expect. You know, maybe big dates and places where not to go.
Anyway, no, he doesn't do that. Does he go within his own timeline? Like Back to the Future 2? You know, maybe just a little bit forward, a little bit back. Kiss your mum. home for tea. No. He's like, I'm going to quote this. This is not me, this is Abby. He sets all his levers to the I'm not a pussy setting, which is otherwise known as going to the year of our Lord, 802,701.
I mean, he could have gone a bit gentle on his first outing. He could have just, like, Groundhog Day'd it.
And why that year? It should have been the year 24,601.
Why?
Les Miserables. That's his number. 24601. You don't know that. I was just thinking the number should have some significance, but it doesn't. We get all the kind of time travel cliches, which no doubt originated here. So he watches the hands on the clocks in his study spins faster and faster. His housekeeper's in there and she's all shooting around like a rocket. Feeling she'll like that in real life, eh?
Yeah,
can't get the staff.
Some real Rosie from the Jetsons.
Yes, yeah, you're right, yeah. Night and day start changing really fast, so in the end it's just like a blur. Buildings crumble around him, trees shoot up in an instant, and so on.
He goes so fast into the future, it kind of feels like he's doing a NASCAR.
He wakes up in the future, or lands in the future, everything's fine. He's in the future!
So he's landed in 802,701 AD. Is Keith Richards still alive?
Would he live in the London area? Because that's another key thing, isn't it? That the time machine doesn't go anywhere. It just goes any when. So maybe Keith Richard would be in LA.
We never talk about other places. He only stays in London, so we don't really know what's happening.
Which I think is partly key to the book as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So he's landed in the future. Keep in mind, he's brought nothing with him. No food, no water, weapons, tools, medicine, not even a change of scanties.
Loo roll.
No loo roll. He complains later on how desperately he needs a smoke and he forgot to bring a pack of camels. I do like to envision him patting the time machine and going, how fast y'all reckon I can get this baby stranded? As he stumbles around this new world, the first thing he notices is an ancient statue of a sphinx, some relic that Britain no doubt stole from Egypt at some point in time. Everything else is in ruins, though, and he worries about what man has become over all this time. Have we become more powerful? Am I about to meet some sort of, you know, demigod? Have we become crueler, nicer, or maybe more effeminate? Maybe we've lost our vigor and our Andrew Tate-ness. Well, he doesn't have to wonder for long, because soon he stumbles on someone. Quote, a slight creature, perhaps 4 feet high, clad in a purple tunic, girdled at the waist with a leather belt. He struck me as being a very beautiful and graceful creature, but indescribably frail. His flushed face reminded me of the more beautiful kind of consumptive. Has he discovered the Keebler elves? What the shit is this?
Is there a law that on podcasts people have to make jokes about the Keebler elves?
Why?
I feel like it's just like every podcast I listen to is just people joking about the Keebler elves.
Oh,
yeah. I don't even know what they are.
So the time traveler wants to have a bit of an explore around, and he disables the time machine so none of these little dudes can go joyriding on it while he's away. You know, he takes out the torque nuts or whatever. Eventually, he's going to start calling these little dudes the Eloi, but he doesn't use that name quite yet, but I think we can just cut to the chase and we can start calling them that. The time traveler really starts to enjoy their company. They have no fear of him, and he loves listening to them prattle on in their funny little language. But he soon discovers that the Eloi are incredibly stupid. Quote, Were these creatures fools? You may hardly understand how it took me. You see, I had always anticipated that the people of the year 802,000-odd would be incredibly in front of us in knowledge, art, and everything. Yet they seemed to be on the intellectual level of one of our 5-year-old children.
I'd always imagined that the people of the year 802,000... What? Again, why that number? What's going on? If somebody knows, it should be the year 800,800 and... What's the one that is boobies? I've forgotten. Should be that, shouldn't it? If you pick a random number, might as well go for something that's get a chuckle out of it. Hey? This is the carry on of the time machine, isn't it? That's where they would go in that. You look up swear words in a dictionary, you write boobies on a calculator. Those are really the only two uses of those things.
So the time traveler has gone from charmed to disappointed. The Eloi cover him in flower garlands, and they take him off to their Edenic utopia, where all they do is run around and eat. Daniel, you know that scene at the beginning of Home Alone where it's just a bunch of chaotic pale people eating and playing and chasing each other around? Yeah. That's what this is. This is a world full of Culkins. So there are piles of weird fruits, and everyone's wearing these chic little tunics and togas. And he's like, my God, this is a Roman orgy of the future. He quickly discovers that all these people eat is fruit. So he has nothing to eat but fruit too. And I bet this man's shits were outrageous. But Wells doesn't give us that scene, of course.
I was wondering that as well. Do the Eloi shit as well? Nice little dolly mixture or something, you know?
What's dolly mixture?
It's like little sweets.
So it's beautiful here, but things are also falling apart a bit. It is like the last days of Rome. But does that mean that Rome is us? And this was a real concern at this point in the Victorian era. I mean, this was the height of Victorian Empire. There were a lot of people being concerned that these are maybe the last days. Society might be on the turn.
Mm-hmm. Like milk.
But milk at least becomes a nice cheese.
Well, this is like a nice cheese, isn't it? I'm just wondering, what do you think their acid reflux was like? If you're lying down eating fruit all day. Time traveler character, he tries to learn the language of the Eloi, but they're really rubbish teachers. They've got bad pedagogy. Right? They haven't got a good pedagogy like us. Quote, but I never met people more indolent or more easily fatigued.
So there's still a white lotus in the future? Is that what you're telling me?
He seems particularly pissed off that the Eloi aren't that very, very interested in him. They'd rather look at just some fruit or something that they've seen a million times before they look at him. He's less interesting than fruit.
Well, to be fair, I wouldn't want to look at Jason Moggsy either.
So, what's going on with the rest of the world then? Our narrator goes off for a walk and discovers Eloi society over, you know, slightly larger area of the Thames Valley, doesn't he? So, everything is sunny and pretty and there's loads of flowers everywhere. It's like Munchkin Land. The Lollipop Guild, they've got no guild system. But apart from that, very similar to Munchkinland. All individual houses seem to not be there. They've just kind of dilapidated or something. And it's all these kind of big communal halls instead.
So like any good capitalist, this guy is using time travel to scope out the future of London real estate.
Ooh, yeah. It's just the bubble's growing bigger and bigger, even in the year 802,000, yeah. So the time traveler thinks, ooh, this is communism, isn't it? You know, they're all dressed the same. They all share the same looks. Men and women are hardly distinguishable. They're all hairless and girlish. That's what we all want out of communism, isn't it? So he thinks that this is like the sort of inevitability of the future, that because everybody's needs have been met, men don't need to be burly because there are no wars and conflicts. Families don't need to be discrete units because there's no sort of competition for resources and stuff like that. So, quote, where violence comes but rarely and offspring are secure, there is less necessity. Indeed, there is no necessity of an efficient family. And the specialization of the sexes with references to their children's needs disappears. You know, if you don't need families, you don't need gender, do you?
The future is so woke.
Men, they're all changing nappies. Women are, you know, having a game of catch with the kids. Cats and dogs live together. They're living in sin. It's, it's kind of it's beautiful in its way, but it is also crazy. So yeah, Wells is sort of building on, maybe parodying other kinds of utopian fiction that were around at the same time.
As he's stumbling around in this wonderful new world, he finds a strange little well. a well of the future. Should we throw in a foreshadowing horn about this well of the future?
It's a bit, it's like a vanity thing, isn't it? The wells.
You think that it's self-promotion rather than, say, kind of an integral part of the plot?
Well, it could have been anything, couldn't it? It didn't have to be a well.
He thinks it looks like a well. He doesn't know what it is. It doesn't have water in it.
He could have thought it looked like a tunnel. He could have thought, but he chose well. Everything's a choice.
Give me your arm, I'm going to bite you. Give it.
No.
Give it. I apologize for biting Daniel, and to the listener for having to hear that. My demons won today. Daniel, I know I barely broke the skin, but you might want to have that looked at. The doctors say I got that Komodo dragon poison in my spit. I'm in a textbook. Anyway, on with the show!
That's funny.
He sits there and watches the sun set over the Thames and looks at all the splendid ruins and thinks that the world looks like a giant garden, sort of a return to Eden, or like a Hieronymus Bosch painting, but with fewer people putting flowers in their buttholes. I mean, one would hope.
Well, that's how he transports the flower back to the present, isn't
no,
it?
No, it is not.
Well, I thought it was. In my version, it was. I think I just had the blue version. Time travel blue edition.
Like Ivanhoe, this also feels like it would be ready for a porn parody.
He goes to the ear boobies. Somebody puts a flower on his bum. It writes itself.
As he contemplates the world of the future, he's like, meet George Jetson, my ass, we're back to being a modern Stone Age family. Quote, it seemed to me that I had happened upon humanity upon the wane. The ruddy sunset set me thinking of the sunset of mankind. For the first time, I began to realize an odd consequence of the society effort in which we were at present engaged. So in other words, he's saying, in my own time, we are making our lives so comfortable with all this wonderful Victorian progress and innovation that we're actually going to breed ourselves to be useless and stupid. Still, doesn't look all bad. It looks like we got rid of annoying bugs like gnats. We got rid of weeds and disease and even social inequality. Everyone looks equal and happy here. Man, foreshadowing klaxon if there ever was one. It gets dark, and the time traveler thinks, well, guess I gotta hit the road. Where did I park my space Buick? Oh yeah, it was right next to that great Sphinx over yonder, wasn't it? But wait a minute. The time machine is gone. Someone or something must have taken it.
You can't find any clues as to the time machine's whereabouts. Or whenabouts. The Eloy...
Sorry, you're just laughing at your own joke like that. It amused you that... Yeah. That was a very hard laugh.
Yeah.
You were as phony as a plugged nickel, and that's what I love about you.
That's not phony. That was completely real. I just came up with it like that. I was just like, shit. I'm onto something here. It's like, oh God, the Eloy haven't, you know, taken it for a joyride and time travel themselves, have they? No. Because I've got the wheel clamp, I've got the car keys in my pocket. Don't worry, it's not POS.
Yeah, it's not like they've gone back to 1955 and are playing Johnny B. Goode somewhere.
So he bursts into one of their big sleeping hole things and lights a match. They're so annoying, aren't they, the Eloy? I really want to... Well, we'll talk about this later. The Eloy, they all wake up and they're all going like, ooh, 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 like bumping into each other and getting upset, crying and things. And he realises that they've forgotten what fire is. He yells, he's like, where's my machine, you assholes? They don't even understand, they don't know what he's on about. He storms off in a huff, and he knocks over one of the Eloy on the way.
Because you just would, wouldn't you?
Yeah, fuck you, Gerald.
So, the time traveller, he goes into detective mode in the morning, because that's just been invented, I don't know, in the 19th century, so he can do that. Finally, a clue, he finds some strange tracks, which resemble those of a sloth.
Daniel, I could not begin to tell you what a sloth's tracks look like. How would this guy know that? Can a sloth even walk, or does it just kind of crawl hang?
So, this might freak people out a bit. The tracks lead into the Sphinx. A little bit more examination of this Sphinx suggests that its pedestal isn't actually made of solid marble. It's actually got some locked doors, panels,
That's some clue shit. That's a secret passage to the conservatory.
You know, all evidence suggests that the machine's locked up inside the Sphinx. So the narrator goes and asks the Eloi to, you know, you mind opening up the older Sphinx for me? And they, quote, react as if he had used a grossly improper gesture to a delicate-minded woman. They went off as if they had received the last possible insult. He sits in despair by the Sphinx and he hears something coming from inside the Sphinx's pedestal. It's a chuckle.
To steal a man's contraption is one thing, but to laugh at him? It's just not cricket, old chap. So, he tries beating open the panel to the Sphinx's plinth, or whatever, with a rock, but it doesn't work. So he's like, fine, I'll look around some more. And he eventually discovers what seems to be some sort of ventilation system underground. Why, what's this for? Is it sanitation? Is it a subway so I can stand on the grate like Marilyn Monroe? I'm not sure, but how cool is that? Maybe that's where all the Eloi industry is, because they can clearly make fabric and jewelry and harvest fruit and everything. But you know what? I haven't seen any factories. I haven't witnessed any labor. Maybe they have all this cool underground tech that does it for them. So with no other moves to make at the moment, he decides to watch the Eloi hanging out by the river. And all they do is play all day, and I'm like, don't you guys have anything better to be doing? Like, shouldn't you be rediscovering crop rotation or something? Suddenly, the time traveler stares in horror as a fast current comes up and sweeps one of them away. So this little Eloi lady starts to drown, but none of the other Eloi know what to do or even seem particularly that bothered. They just kind of let it happen.
That's what you have to do in that situation, though, isn't it? That's what they always say. You're only going to endanger yourself. Just let them drown.
Daniel Jenkins Smith, lifeguard, everybody. The time traveler takes off all of his clothes, jumps in, and saves her. Back on land, and remember, he is presumably buck-ass naked, he starts rubbing her limbs all over, which I guess is what they used to do before CPR. And it does.
So, do you have to take off your clothes to go in a 2-inch deep puddle?
I think it's a flex. I think it's just, look what I got.
Yeah.
And this whole scene does have slightly sexual undertones.
Mm.
And she starts following him around like a puppy. A real thirsty puppy. She becomes his, quote, little woman. And he discovers that her name is Weena. Wow, what an annoying name. How funny would it be if that weren't her name at all, but she's just pointing at his naked ass and saying Weener in a British accent? Like, that's the one word in English that survived. Now, Weena is not robust enough to keep up with him in his explorations of the world, and she keeps sort of feebly calling for him to wait for her whenever he walks around.
Mm.
Quote, I had not come into the future to carry on a miniature flirtation. But, despite him saying that, they spend the whole afternoon shyly smiling at each other and giving each other flowers and kissing each other's hands. This book really asks us the question, hey, do you guys think I should get it on with this peeled potato? The jury's still out. And I did actually want to pause here for a minute. This is probably better for the analysis. But why do time travel narratives always have some sort of sexual story or romantic story? Like, is it an incest taboo thing? Or is it like a our love can never be thing? Because this whole relationship does have something kind of weirdly kinky going on. We are one In Excess song away from this being Hot Tub Time Machine.
So, apparently the Eloi are terrified of darkness. That's why they all just rush to these great holes after dark and they stay in these big groups. One night, he's awoken from his creepy hobbit bed to see some strange grey figure scurrying away. So he looks out in the early morning fog and, quote, fancied I saw a solitary white ape-like creature running rather quickly up the hill, carrying some dark body before vanishing into the bushes.
Hey, do you guys have some kind of shy neighbor? Like that home improvement guy who peeks over the fence?
Yeah. As day breaks, he's like, oh no, it must have been the light playing tricks on me. Or maybe the only reasonable explanation is that they were ghosts. Maybe these days, in the future, The world's full of ghosts because so many people must have died.
Could you imagine if this book were populated with ghosts from 2020? It's just a bunch of people calling you Chugi and singing WAP.
I know WAP. What's Chugi?
Oh, give us a minute, everybody. I need to explain to Daniel what Chugi means.
On day four, the time traveler goes to a ruin that he's not visited before, and in the gloom, he sees a pair of creepy eyes watching him.
Ugh, f***ing Craster's Keep up here. Game of Thrones, Daniel, keep going. You don't know. Okay.
He sees it then. It runs out. It's this creepy, pale, ape-like creature. The kind of thing he saw before. You know, so it wasn't a ghost.
Yeah, no shit, time traveler.
Well, he showed people a ghost that time, so maybe he's getting high on his own supply. I don't know. Quote, dull white with strange large greyish-red eyes and flaxen hair on its head and down its back. I cannot even say whether it ran on all fours or only with its forearms held very low.
Sounds like a Busey.
Again, what's that? I was going to say you.
I'm waiting for my apology.
I'm sorry. What's a Busey?
Gary, like, Busey?
Gary Busey. Are there other Buseys?
Jake Busey. I am so mad that you said that right now, you fucking onion. Normally I'd call you a potato, but a potato's never made me cry.
Very funny. So these creatures are what he comes to call the Morlocks. That's what they're called. So he didn't really respect the Eloi, but he despises the Morlocks. He's a professional hater. He's a hater.
He's drunk the haterade.
The haters are going to hate.
Etc, etc.
He tries to follow it, this creature, and he comes to another abandoned looking well. Creepy well. All is not well, hey? could it have gone down there? So he lights a match, one of his famous matches, peers down, sees the thing scurry down some footholds like, quote, a human spider.
Ugh, what in the Jamie Gum?
Stop. I want to put a moratorium. I don't know what any of these things are.
Do you not know Jamie Gum from Silence of the Lambs?
Is he the villain?
Yes, with the well that he keeps people down and scurries around in a subterranean. Have you never seen Silence
of
the Lambs?
I don't know every character's name. I never know any character's names and things.
Okay, then why are you yelling at me for knowing?
Just the onslaught of things that I just don't know.
I'm sorry. How would you suggest we fix this?
Maybe more references to the Frankfurt School and fewer to 20th century popular culture.
I forget that typically a man would not host a literature podcast if he had been the prom king. I forgot. I'm sorry.
I don't even get that.
Because you're a nerd. Ah, and you don't get all the cool pop culture references. Right.
Oh, I don't even get that. Back to the summary.
So sorry.
So gradually, quote, gradually the truth dawned on me that man had not remained one species but had differentiated into two distinct animals.
This really is the Cola Wars of evolutionary biology.
Indeed it is, yeah. That's something I do get.
Come on.
Pepsi.
Pound it. You did it hard.
Sorry.
Is that your latent aggression? You're actually punching.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. So my graceful children of the upper world were not the sole descendants of our generation, but that this bleached, obscene, nocturnal thing was also heir to all the ages. He realizes that humanity is a split on class lines into these two sort of devolved subspecies. The Eloi were once the upper classes and the Morlocks the labouring classes.
So I actually take it back. This isn't the Cola Wars. This is Jim Henson's class warfare babies.
Indeed it is. Yes, very good. The narrator thinks he's like, oh, so all the servants and the workers have to live in this like semi-troglodytic way of living in the 19th century. It's obviously got worse since, and they've sort of evolved accordingly. He's like, so there's no real middling group, okay?
The middle class is a lie.
Yeah. Above ground, quote, you must have the haves, pursuing pleasure and comfort and beauty, and below ground, the have-nots, the workers, getting continuously adapted to the conditions of their labour.
Oh no, class inequality? Well, Daniel, I, for one, am breathing a little easier knowing that Jason Moggsy is on the case. I'm sure this guy doesn't have any vested interests at all.
So it's not a utopia, it's the other one, the bad-topia, dystopia. So it's like The Good Place, isn't it, when she says it's not The Good Place. Popular reference, I didn't write that.
Yeah, but you've seen it.
I have seen, that's the thing, I've even seen it, but it would never have occurred to me to write it.
But back to the point at hand. Okay, this is kind of a horrible future for humanity, but where is my time machine? And why do the Morlocks want it? And why can't the Eloi, their masters, make them give it back? Ratio, fuck this Six Ways to Sunday. I'm gonna go ask the Morlocks myself. Down the well I go. Now, he experiences some instant buyer's remorse as soon as he goes down that ladder into the darkness. It's uncomfortable, it's dark, and it's filled with the heavy clanking of machinery. Clearly, this is where all the industry is, but it's kept away from the beautiful Eden above. So the time traveler, he lights some matches to light his way, and he runs into some Morlocks. And they're a bit curious about him, but they give him a lot of distance.
Friend?
They just wanted something to love, didn't they?
That is the simplest you have ever looked. Your whole posture changed. You're about to ask me for some French fried potatoes.
What's that?
Sling blade.
What's that? Am I like a Morlock? Have I been living in a cave or something? The stuff you're saying, it sounds like you come from a different planet.
The Morlocks are a bit curious about him, but they give him distance because of the matches, and he soon realizes that the light hurts their sensitive eyes.
Hey, I'll tell you what. They've met their match.
So this is why they only come out at night. And he stumbles on their dining hall, and he actually sees a big haunch of meat on their lunch trays, and he's like, well, okay, so at least they're carnivorous, unlike the Eloi. But he's horrified to discover that he only has 4 matches left. He's like, oh, why did I waste all my matches showing off for the Eloi with my magic tricks? You know, they didn't know what fire was. I thought I was daddy cool. He's determined to save his last 4 matches for emergencies only. Now, without the glare of the match light, the Morlocks creep closer, and he feels them touching him all over, and creepily they're trying to pry the box of matches out of his hands. He's like, oh, I could really easily be overwhelmed here. So he strikes a match, and they all hiss at the light, and, you know, he runs to find an exit. This is a very, very tense scene. There are lots of close calls, lots of matches burning out and stumbling in the dark and hearing the Morlocks chasing him and feeling their creepy little hands on his clothes.
The way you're describing it, it sounds like you think this is a good bit.
Anything with little creepy fingies all over you, I'm like, oh no, I loved it. And only just as his very last match flickers out, he makes it to the ladder and crawls back into the sunlight, where he immediately faints in front of an astonished Weena.
The Morlocks didn't hurt him, they're just curious, like the Eloi. The time traveler nonetheless decides that they're, quote, inhuman and malign. Okay, true, I hate the Eloi for not being more like me, but now I found someone we can hate even more together.
The doctors say I got a case of the boomers.
Exactly. So the time traveler, he can't quite figure out what's actually going on, what the dynamic is between the Eloi, who he has interpreted to be the masters, and the Morlocks, who are supposed to be their ugly mechanical servants. Until the dynamic's clearer, he thinks, I should keep exploring. So in the very far distance, he sees this strange building, and he thinks it looks like it's made out of green Chinese porcelain. He decides to hike there, Weena tags along, and like all women, she's delighted to discover that the time traveler has pockets.
She's never dreamed of such delights as pockets. Pockets for days, pockets for miles.
So she's constantly putting things in the pockets, namely flowers. Speaking of, says our narrator, cut the narrative. Speaking of, that's right, reader. Yeah, you remember, right? This is all being told by an unnamed narrator who's just recounting word for word what the time traveler told him. The time traveler breaks up his story, reaches into his dirty pockets, and produces a weird flower. He puts it on the table in the year of our Lord, 1895, and he's like, this is my proof. I've never seen a flower like this.
But on with his tale. He and Weena are exhausted. He's like, okay, this looks like a place where we can hunker down, like doomsday preppers. I don't know what this weird building is, but maybe it'll have weapons, the means to make fire, and some tools so I can break into the Sphinx's platform and rescue my time machine. They break into the Palace of Green Porcelain and discover in the front room, the lobby or whatever, a giant skeleton. And he's like, I'm sorry, is that the skeleton of a giant sloth? oh my god, is it a big Morlock? It's a very sloth-heavy book, isn't it? But then he's like, no. That, friend, I recognize it. That is a Megatherium. And what's that over there? Is that a Brontosaurus skeleton? This is a museum! In fact, this is the South Kensington Museum, which, as a fun fact to modern listeners, this is now known as the Natural History Museum in London. And he's like, why, this only opened in my time a few years ago, as part of our scientific advancements as studious Victorians. And now it's in ruins, and I'm as old as some of the things on display. So there's a lot of irony in this museum section. And Daniel, can I just say that hiking 18 miles with your sweetie just to end up at a museum sounds like a German honeymoon?
Sounds like a good one. Is that what you mean? No, that does sound like that. So the museum has seemingly been sacked, possibly by Morlocks. So he decides to sack it too. In sacking this place, there's a kind of bit of irony here, isn't there? That, you know, he and the Morlocks maybe have a little bit in common, after all.
We're not so different, you and I.
Exactly. He's looking for supplies. It's a bit like Robinson Crusoe, this bit, isn't it? Looking for supplies and, oh, how lucky, I happen to have a big shipwreck full of presents. Oh, how, you know, there's a big museum here and it's all, oh, look at this, it's got a hot plate in it. He finds some kind of bit of metal that he's going to use as a mace to bludgeon unsuspecting Morlocks. And he's, I love this bit. He's like, I longed very much to kill a Morlock or so. Very inhuman, you may think, to want to go killing one's own descendants. But it was quite impossible, somehow, to feel any humanity in the things. That's the time travel spirit I want. I'm just going to go and kill stuff.
Some big celebrations are in order when he and Weena find a crowbar and a box of matches. Quote, this is my favorite bit in the book, by the way.
Okay.
And so, in that derelict museum, upon the thick, soft carpeting of dust, to Weena's huge delight, I solemnly performed a kind of composite dance. In part, it was a modest can-can, in part a step dance, in part a skirt dance, so far as my tailcoat permitted. Girl, those Capizios are not gonna know what hit them. A can-can? My dude has gone full Moulin Rouge. He's going around saying, come and get me, Aloys. Because she says, come and get me, boys. You're looking at me blankly.
I do feel a bit like all dissociated. It's like some 18th century person raising their child to like learn all the wrong words.
Yeah, you're like one of those dog tooth children.
Yes, that I haven't seen.
But you know.
Yes.
Okay.
I do know that.
Okay. Daniel, what do you need from me emotionally today?
Just press on, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, time to make the big trek back to the Sphinx and get my ride out of car jail. So he and Weena leave the museum and they go through a forest nearby, and he grabs a bunch of firewood so he can build a bonfire to sleep near and thereby stay safe in case there are any Morlocks in the area. So sure enough, the sun starts to go down and he spots a group of Morlocks stalking him and Weena from the bushes. Quick, Weena, I must light a torch to protect us. But oh no, how can I brandish a torch when I'm also carrying a crowbar, a club, and an arm full of firewood? I just can't do it, Weena. So he...
That's funny.
So he has to abandon the firewood, but what if I light some pieces of firewood on fire in my wake? That way it'll be too bright for the Morlocks to follow us and we can, you know, sort of escape. So that's what he does, and he plays this terrifying game of cat and mouse with more and more groups of Morlocks springing up out of hammer space, but, you know, they're driven back by his little arsonist Hansel and Gretel routine. He loses his way in the forest and realizes, I'm not going to get out of here tonight. We're going to have to camp in the woods, but it's not all bad. He's got his weird little girlfriend, he's got a cozy campfire, adrenaline's high. I'm sure he pitches a tent.
Don't even know what to say to that. It's like a double entendre thing.
That was absolutely a single entendre. What could you mean by it?
That's the stupidest plan ever, isn't it? Leaving bits of fire.
Yes.
Despite making a big blazing campfire to keep the Morlocks at bay, he wakes in the morning to find little hands all over him.
Is it Weena? Is she getting frisky again?
Weena? Get off my Weena. That's your joke, yeah.
So, that's not my joke.
Yeah, I'm just building on the previous one.
Oh, you're yes-anding me. Okay, yeah. Keep going.
So he's being pinned down a bit like in Gulliver's Travels. In his exhaustion, he'd fallen asleep, he let the fire go out, and he's being more locked, is the point. So he grabs his matches in his pocket, they're all gone. The Morlocks, the first thing they did was they nicked his matches from his pocket while he was asleep.
I like that they pickpocketed him, the Morlocks, I just thought that. Little Cockney urchins.
Yeah.
Where's Wiener? He looks around, she's gone, she's disappeared. Wham bam, thank you ma'am, that sort of thing. So
I feel so used.
This is not my terminology, but it's the best way of phrasing it. He hulks out and flings off the, quote, human rats and bludgeons a bunch of them with his mace.
This is a perfect combination of an Abby and Daniel sentence. It's my terminology, but we get gory boy violence for you.
I don't normally love that stuff, but...
But in this case, you want to see all these little creeps dead.
Well, I put this quote in because I really liked it. Quote, I could feel the succulent giving of flesh and bone under my blows. So he's surrounded, the Morlocks circling closer and closer. It's very exciting. It looks like it's curtains for him. Do they have curtains in the future?
Yes.
Okay, so... But then all of a sudden, the Morlocks freeze and scurry off. Ooh, what's that? It's obviously a much, much bigger Morlock, isn't it? A really scary beast. Or is it Wiener? She's arrived with all the Eloys, like Gandalf at Helm's Deep. No. A lot of smoke. And you know what they say about smoke?
No, they haven't just elected the next Morlock Pope.
He started a forest fire.
Why do I feel like the Time Traveler is no stranger to committing ecological atrocities?
That's, again, it's so such a colonial narrative, isn't it? You just go there, you let your cat out. Like, so you know those stories about lighthouse keepers on some tropical island and they have their cat for company and it just makes the whole species extinct of birds or whatever.
Yeah.
He's just like that, isn't he?
So, the fire rages up behind him faster than he expected, and now he and the Morlocks are running neck and neck to safety.
Do they have necks?
No, they're a bit like the... Is it the Blemmy who have their...
Yeah, okay.
Is it the Blemmy who have their faces just in their chest?
In their tummy.
So, meanwhile, he watches as the Morlocks are running next to him for safety, and something of a red mist descends on the Time Traveler seeing this. His eyes, like, you know, turn to black ink, and he starts walloping them with his iron mace, because... those guys, am I right? Hey, your great-grandparents were poor. He makes it out of the forest just in the nick of time, and he goes to this open hill and just watches the whole forest burn. And there's no sign of Wiener. So he's like, man, even if she hasn't been killed by the Morlocks, which she probably was in the night, she has certainly been killed by the fire. So he beats the ground for a minute and does the whole, why, God, sort of thing. And he does that for like 2 seconds before discovering, oh, hey-ho, good news. That box of matches that the Morlocks nicked out of me pocket, well, it had actually leaked a couple of matches before they nabbed it. Is each match a fucking horcrux for this dude? There are other ways to, like, make and maintain fire. This is a man who is currently staring at a massive forest fire, and he's excited about having some matches.
But that's what I was saying before, that he was so out of his element here, that he's not a wilderness survival guy. He's in a tailcoat, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, I know, seriously. So, he walks all the way back to where he had landed, and this is when he realizes that the Eloi are just cattle. They're fat and happy and stupid, with only enough knowledge to fear their executioner. He kind of pieces it all together at this point. He's like, the Eloi have all their needs met by the grueling labor of the Morlocks, just like the upper classes in my day. But somewhere along the line, the lower classes decided to literally eat the rich. And now they keep the aristocracy as livestock, picking off one or two whenever it's dark. Humanity has become cannibalistic.
He gets his crowbar from the special crowbar exhibit, Hall of Crowbars, in the museum. Yeah, he's ready to break into the Sphinx, and he's like, oh, wait one moment here, the grate's already open. So the time machine is there, it's looking pretty as a picture. Maybe the Morlocks even polished it up a bit. Got a little green smelly tree hanging from the windshield or whatever thing, the rear mirror, that's it. He crawls into the base of the Sphinx, and the Morlocks shut the grate, and... it's all a trap. They start laughing. He feels them all creeping around him. And he's like, well, I'll have the last laugh because I've got the matches. He's like, prepares to get one of these matches, these loose matches from his pocket out to strike it, freak out the Morlocks. You never guess what happens.
What, he's lost the matches or something?
No, they're safety matches. They're the damnable kind, or whatever he calls it, that can only be struck with the box. So, oh no, I can't light the match after all, hoops. And he's like, okay, gents, if you just bear with me for a couple of seconds, then I will really have the last laugh. He fights off the Morlocks, you know, kicks one in the
future, bread basket.
Future balls, yeah, whatever.
Future balls!
He tries to screw the car keys thing back into the time machine or whatever, and then he disappears. And the Morlocks are all just, we assume, just there, just going, friend? Where's go friend?
So, does he travel home for some much-needed rest? Nope. He travels way, way into the future. This time, where the Eloi have seemingly evolved even further, and now they're like creepy pale moth people, and the Morlocks have evolved even further into some weird sort of green crab people. The future world is covered in green vegetation, but also it somehow looks incredibly dead. So he takes one look at this new world and he nopes out of there real fast. Now, is this the point where he goes home?
Yes.
No! Oh. He goes as far forward as he can, and he sees that everything is dead, and the sun is expanding and ready to explode. He's like, thanks, I hate it! Back to my own time, please! So, we cut back to his Victorian dinner of men with their big bristly faces. He's like, so that was the future. Kind of a mixed bag. Anyway, I basically got home an hour ago, and that brings us up to the present. And all the Victorian men are super quiet and seemingly don't believe him. And they're like, wow, that's a fun story. Maybe you should have been a short story writer. This sounds like an episode of The Magic School Bus I didn't know I didn't want. And I'm kind of with these guys, Daniel. This isn't proof. That flower is probably a deep fake, and I think somebody should apprehend this charlatan. It's a real shame that Weena died and wasn't able to go with him as proof. She was eminently trafficable.
Oh, yeah.
And it's...
And how? Our unnamed narrator is maybe a little bit more disturbed by the story than most. So he goes back to see the time traveler the next day. The time traveler is already packing for his next trip.
This guy has never even heard of resisting the call to adventure. He's like, Bilbo who? And you know why that is? You know why he can't seem to resist the call to adventure? Cocaine!
Do you think that's what he's packing?
Yes!
All right. So he's like, I'm going to be more prepared this time. And the narrator's like, come on, male mucker. Was it all a hoax? And the time traveler is like, if you can wait half an hour, I'll prove it to you. You can stay here, you know, just twiddle your thumbs, you know, go through my magazine rack. I'll go on my adventure, and when I come back, I'll set the machine to land half an hour from now, and we'll have a good old chin wag about what I've been up to. I'll take some pictures, I'll show you some specimens, and it will prove that it's bona fide. Again, why half an hour? Why wait half an hour? You could come back immediately, couldn't you? Not all of us have time machines. So, you know, I can't just piss my life away like you can. So then he hears a funny noise. So he goes back into the thing and he says, oh, God, the time traveler's gone and the machine is also gone. He must have traveled through time. Quote, I stayed on waiting for the time traveler, waiting for the second, perhaps still stranger story and the specimens and photographs that he would bring with him. But I am beginning now to fear that I must wait a lifetime. The time traveler vanished 3 years ago. And as everyone knows now, he has never returned. The end.
So either he died or got stranded or is actually living his best life in a little South Kensington communist hall.
Or could it be like Back to the Future where he went back to the wrong time?
Timeline. Oh my God, what have I done? Biff Tannen is running everything.
Donald Trump.
Weena has huge fake boobs, like what's her face, and
yeah.
Back to the Future Part 2.
This is actually my dream future. That's what he's saying.
Oh, yeah. I'll stay here.
Back to the Year boobies and.
Would you like some casting?
I bloody would.
I think one of the best directors for this strange, strange little piece is Tom Hooper, because it needs equal parts the costume drama realism of The King's Speech and also the camp twee horrors and fursuits of cats. I need Colin Firth stammering realism and a hint of CGI buttholes.
Right.
That's what this
is. Colin Firth going to be your time traveler then?
No.
Okay.
As my time traveler, I think it's got to be Paul Bettany, because that's an actor who looks both like a posh Victorian and like he's seen through the horrors of the ages. I love Paul Bettany because he always looks like he's just been freshly juiced. And now for our segment, Bad Goodreads Reviews. Little Weena would be a great name for a pug. 1 star. On the first page, this book already starts by calling redheads argumentative, and it just gets worse from there. There is also the presence of classism. 1 star. Yep, that's the point, that classism is bad. You kinda got it. Did Orson Welles also write a book on how to write the most boring things you'll ever read? 1 star. I think you mean H.G. Wells. And no. Okay, let's do some analysis, please.
Okay.
Do we want to start where we normally do, which is with the form of the text? Because this is kind of an unusual telling. I actually thought the pacing in this was fantastic. I mean, it's only a short little book. And I was thinking, especially with the bad Goodreads, this is another one like The Stepford Wives, which I didn't include any of these, but tons of people thought this was so boring and like they couldn't even finish it despite it being barely 100 pages. And I don't know what it is, but people seem to really dislike things that are full of slow dread. I think people want horror that is instant slasher from page one. But to me, the slow dread is the scarier thing.
The bit that, maybe not scared or upset, it's not quite the word, but just right at the end of his adventure when he sees the Earth die and he sees this kind of disgusting, like, slobbery life form thing. And
it's horrible.
He's like, he just goes, like, I just got a sort of, it's a bit Schopenhauerian. He's just like, I got a sense of the kind of the primal dread at the core of the universe.
Yeah.
And I was just a bit like, yeah, that would get you down. And it's got me down now. So, yeah, I thought it was good for that. But that maybe that's a certain kind of feeling that people don't necessarily expect from science fiction.
Him going back, now every day is filled with that slow boiling dread of not being
inevitability,
able to
yeah,
avoid this and seeing it happen in real time. So of course he has to keep going on his adventures. Maybe that's why he goes forward and never comes back.
Yes, no, that seems like obviously the case.
What about that frame narrative? We're only interrupted once in the middle to remind us, remember, you're not hearing this directly from the time traveler, you're hearing it from his guest who's relaying it to you.
Yeah, I had a few different ideas on this. One, the narration itself is a sort of time-traveling device, isn't it? The magic of story. But that is true, though, isn't it? Like, you just can cut from one time to another in a story and no one bats an eyelid. You manipulate time when you tell a narrative, don't you? So I kind of thought the idea of him doing that complements what he's up to. I also thought that idea that we don't fully know how true it is. It's like only his testimony. But he himself, this is something I'm going to get onto later, but he himself constantly admits that the things that he's observing and the analysis or the interpretations that he's making, he's like, that could be wrong. So I kind of think it's about layers of mediation, which is good for ghost stories as well, isn't it? Like with Turn of the Screw, that this has got so many layers of mediation that the mystery kind of slips through the gaps.
Yeah, and that idea that we are separated from our future. So obviously there are links, there are years that we could live, there are our descendants, but we are always going to be held at arm's length. And I think that's why that narration, that relay narration, is important to sort of show, unless we have a time machine, we can never actually really know if it's true or false. We just have these hypotheses. I also thought this idea of form, and this is the thing that really tripped up a lot of people in the bad Goodreads, where they're like, ugh, he's so privileged, I hated this narrator so much. And, like, you're supposed to. One of the things that you realize over this is whose perspective this is from. This is being told through the eyes of a very wealthy man who kind of doesn't have any labor to do at all. He's like the Eloy, just playing around with his little tricks all day. But this brings us to ideas of class and servants. And the thing that I always talk to my students about we talked about this in Jekyll and Hyde, where it's like things can be conspicuous by their absence. Mm. And in Jekyll and Hyde, it was like, where are all the women in this story? Mm. This is kind of a queer story. In this, where are all the servants? So he briefly mentions his housekeeper, and at the end, there's brief chat about his manservant, but those are the very, like, highest levels of servants. Those are basically almost middle-class servants, right? But let's not forget that this whole book takes place over two big Victorian dinner parties. Mm. These people are being served. They talk about food and drink being served. We do not notice
the narrator servants. Explicitly says the time traveler didn't like to have his servants hanging on him.
Mm-hmm.
So they, like, serve the table and then make themselves absent.
Exactly. So we never see them. Like, they are already scurrying around underground, making life comfortable and not attracting you to their presence. And that's a way that it really embeds it. My question is, do the Morlocks actually do anything wrong? Because going off of that, the fact that he assumes so much, he kind of just doesn't like the look of them.
Mm.
A lot of this is him inferring things. So yeah, as you said, we know they eat meat. We don't know what kind of meat. We know that Eloy sleep in groups and avoid the dark and avoid the wells. But apart from the Morlocks kind of feeling up the narrator and looking spooky and being curious about him, we have no evidence that they're cannibalistic, nor that this would even count as cannibalism if they're kind of different species now.
Yeah.
And if he's...
Which they definitely are. Whatever the interpretation, they definitely are different species.
But also, like, he talks about them in these very animalistic terms. If they're animals, is it morally wrong for an animal to be carnivorous? Like, he's putting a lot of judgment on them.
His view of how evolution works is that sort of essentialization of social patterns that really are very contingent to the 19th century. So I kind of really, I thought there's something really weird going on here.
Well, it's very imperialist.
Yeah.
And that's a huge undercurrent in this book. That's why we have the Sphinx and all this stuff. It's that everything he sees, he can only conceptualize it through his normal views. And that's why he's constantly comparing them to Rome, is like, is this our downfall? Could we talk about the literalized metaphor of the upper classes consuming their workers, but here it's kind of reversed with a wink?
Yeah, that's funny, isn't it? Because,
I mean, the point is, you know, Wells being a lower middle class person, his parents were servants, he was very political, he understands the idea of the upper classes only surviving on the labor of the working classes, right? But here it's got that funny twist of, you consume us, we consume you.
It's a nice solution, isn't it?
That would get you eating meat again.
Well,
Jeff Bezos is delicious.
I want that guy that gets his teenage son's blood. I bet that guy's tasty.
No, he's gonna taste like weird pastes and things. That is not a succulent bite.
I thought it'd be like that veal that hides in a.
Okay, what about the sex and relationships in this? Because his relationship with Weena has always made people a bit uneasy. There is a kind of incest or pedophilic reading. There's kind of a bestiality reading. What function does she serve?
I was just thinking, that is such a science fiction thing, isn't it? Teaching alien women to love. It's just such a dynamic.
I think it's supposed to make you feel uneasy in that clearly humanity is already breaking down and it feels weird. And, you know, is this, you know, where are these species boundaries? So I think it's supposed to sort of push that line of discomfort.
Mm.
I was thinking, though, that if the time traveler felt the need to hook up with a person from the future, he actually could view the Morlocks as a lot more alluring, because they're just kind of popping out, giving him these coy little peeks every now and then. It's very, ooh, don't look at me, I'm shy. Meanwhile, the Eloi just have, like, their tits hanging out in the middle of Charing Cross Road, and Weena's following around everywhere. It's very, like, calm down, bitch, you look desperate. What about green? A lot of people have noted how much green there is in this book. His coat and the Sphinx are covered in green slime. There's the green porcelain palace. The world is a new Eden, always in bloom. So, like, that kind of seems hopeful to me. That's a sign of sort of new life and new growth. I wondered if that was a sort of, like, you know, we keep going, even if the forms would seem horrifying to us now.
But I thought, like we talked about before with the existential horror, it's that like idea of life as a kind of blind and grasping force that doesn't really have any meaning to it. So I feel like the greenness is that sort of scary vitality.
All right, so here's some advice. So be really careful when you're critiquing popular or genre fiction that you don't accidentally stumble into classism or sexism or things like that. So it's really important to remember that just because something is popular doesn't mean that it's beneath you. Just because you might not like something doesn't mean it's bad. It just might not be for you. And I'd like you guys to really think about, what does literary even mean? In fact, I think it's important that even if a book is badly or formulaically written, but it reaches a really high level of popularity, that's something that you can work with. Analyze, what has this book tapped into in the current public spirit that makes it so popular? Why are people latching onto it, especially if it's not written very skillfully?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's definitely true.
So, are you ready for our clue to the next episode?
Yes.
Daniel, it's springtime, and you know what that means. Spring cleaning.
Hooray! Get my rubber gloves on.
Our next book needs it, too, because it is very dusty.
That's good. Yeah, a dusty old tome, I'm imagining.
So, please write into our email at savemefrommyshelf@gmail.com. We are on Twitter, TikTok, and Instagram. Please join our Patreon and join us next week if you want to hear outtakes from this episode, along with the Bad Sex Awards and our catch-up session on Bad Goodreads and all that stuff. So our Bookends episode will be coming out next Wednesday.
It's been another lovely episode. Thank you, Abby. And
you're welcome. Daniel,
I hope to speak to all you listeners again soon.
You were pinching your nose briefly. Are you pained saying goodbye to people?
Looks like it.
Just parting is such sweet sorrow.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for listening to Save Me From My Shelf. Our music is The Overture to Don Giovanni by Mozart, and cover art is by Catherine Wu. Our thanks to Aston University's Center for Critical Inquiry into Society and Culture for funding the startup of this podcast. Contact us at savemefrommyshelf@gmail.com or at smfms_podcast on Twitter. And do not, I'm going to remind you, do not forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Do not forget. Thank you.